This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. New Hampshire will send Democrats to Washington, but picked Republicans to lead in Concord. And in that big race, the top of the ticket, New Hampshire chose Hillary Clinton, but by an oh-so-narrow margin. And so a state, our state, that was expected to be so pivotal in deciding national political questions, U.S. Senate balance, and maybe the presidency. Well, that didn't come to pass, but we still got plenty to talk about. Join us for the Friday News Roundup, Election Autopsy Edition. Scrubbing in this week are Kevin Landergan of the New Hampshire Union Leader, Casey McDermott of NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University. And you join us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, all. Obviously, a lot to talk about, and we're hoping to spend much of our time on state and local races and what they mean. But I've got to start with the big one. While New Hampshire voters did choose Hillary Clinton, the margin was tight, 2,500 votes. Is there anything telling about that, or just another example of New Hampshire swinging in its own fashion with the tide? What do you think, Dean?
We've talked for months now that the conventional wisdom in New Hampshire in recent presidential elections has been that Democrats, all things being equal, typically do better at presidential years and have not done quite as well at midterm elections. This was a presidential year. The expectation was, and a lot of the polling showed, that Hillary Clinton would win the state. There were some pretty significant gaps in the from one poll to the next, different organizations showing a different level of tightness. In the end, it ended up being extremely tight. Hillary Clinton ended up right now has 47.6% of the vote to Donald Trump at 47.3% of the vote. It's about a 2,500 vote margin out of right around 700,000 ballots cast. So, I think just talking to Democrats around the state, they're obviously unhappy with how the presidential race turned out. But given that the Democrats lost the presidency, the feeling is that, in the end, Democrats, for as close as it was, did okay here. They picked up an all-female Democratic congressional delegation. It's interesting that, we talked a lot about whether or not there would be split ticketing in the state and or people would sort of pick and choose which races they voted in. And as it turned out, that Senate race had the highest number of total votes. So people were pretty interested in that. So, in the end, New Hampshire, as you mentioned, was not the pivotal state. I mean, Hillary Clinton was really done in by the upper Midwest and the Rust Belt, which abandoned Democrats in places like Wisconsin, which had not happened in many, many years, and Michigan and even Pennsylvania, which had been a Democratic sort of part of the blue, so-called blue wall.
Well, I mean, to that point, I mean, there's an argument out there we're seeing post-election, and, to some extent it was going on during the election that we're seeing a decoupling going on within both parties along class lines, and that populist elite divide would appear to have, helped Trump here and ultimately hurt Clinton. And, if you look at what you might consider New Hampshire's Rust Belt, places like Claremont and Rochester, Trump did pretty well, didn't he, Casey?
He did. It's actually interesting. I pulled the numbers on this last night. And if you look at Claremont, voted Dem in the last three presidential election cycles. Barack Obama won there pretty handily, both in 2008 and 2012. But if you look this year, Trump won 49% to 46% there. Another town with kind of a, similarly has been hard hit economically, has suffered under the loss of manufacturing jobs as Rochester on the other side of the state. That's another place that has consistently voted Democrat in the past, at least in presidential election years, going back to 2004 with John Kerry and as well as 2008 and 2012 with Barack Obama. This year, there was a 10-point difference in the victory between Trump and or over Clinton. It was 52% to 42% in Rochester in Trump's favor. So I think that really speaks to kind of the dynamic that we're seeing across the country in terms of, places that have been distressed economically, that, you know, where Trump's message of kind of bringing back jobs that have been lost to trade deals, promising kind of economic revitalization, would really resonate. And I think that, you know, those are both places where Trump held rallies over the course of his campaign. I was not at the rally, but I know that, you know, in Claremont in particular and in Rochester, they were pretty heavily attended, very enthusiastic crowds.
I attended a rally that Trump had before the primary in January. It was, you know, hovering around zero, and there were thousands of people inside the basketball gym at Stevens High School. And, you know, at the time, Corey Lewandowski from New Hampshire was Trump's campaign manager. And he kind of grabbed me by the arm and pointed up into the bleachers and, you know, was making the point essentially, see, look at what we've got. And, you know, I have to say, I'm not sure I really did at that point. And he's certainly a guy capable of saying such things, even when there might not be much there. But, you know, it turns out there was something there. And, you know, Kevin, Trump didn't win here, as we know, but his performance in communities like the ones we've mentioned and in smaller towns did seem to lift Republicans.
No, it sure did. I think Trump had a lot to do with the Republicans doing well up down ballot. There isn't any question about that. What was staggering to me, however, is that the voter anger that we talked about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, was really palpable on Election Day. Because while Trump did well, you have to also look at the party in power. Look at the ballot in New Hampshire and look what happened, essentially, right? In the party in power, there were changes from right below Trump Clinton right on down. The party in power, for governor, a Democrat changes to a Republican. The party in power, a Republican senator changes to Democrat. The party in power in the first congressional district, a Republican congressman gets ousted. So Trump's strength was strong, but there was something else going on, and I think it was this voter anger. And I think that's why exit polling in New Hampshire and in other states essentially showed that among people who didn't like both candidates, Trump won by as much as 20%. So, and these are people essentially voting
at
change.
At this moment in time, that's,
you know, and these are people
number.
Who these are people who even don't like Trump, but who base and again, national exit polling saying among people there were as many as 20% of the people who said Trump was unfit to be president, they voted for him anyway. So, again, that's just voting for change. I'm going to take a risk. And they were willing to do that. And I think that's why we saw some of the startling results, not just in New Hampshire, but in those Rust Belt states that Casey talked about.
Well, you look at the one person who, you know, may have been hurt by this dynamic was Senator Ayotte. This was obviously the race that got the most attention in New Hampshire aside from the presidency. And Ayotte lost to Governor Hassan by just over 1,000 votes. It wasn't settled until Wednesday. The polling had this race close from the start. You know, 120 million plus in spending, balance of the Senate was thought to be at stake, wasn't. You know, is it fair to say Ayotte's walking away from Trump could have been decisive in this race?
Hard to say. You know, it was certainly a difficult position for her to be in all along. You know, and particularly in the context of all the national attention she received as a result of her kind of strategic positioning vis-a-vis him, until she finally cut herself loose after the allegations of sexual assault. You know, this was a tough race for both of them. They're both sort of well-known, generally popular politicians. You know, Hassan did have a little bit of an edge going into it since it was a presidential year, but even so, it was essentially a dead heat. And, you know, you did have these two other candidates in the race, Aaron Day, who was independent but conservative and specifically got into the race because he was unhappy with Kelly Ayotte, and Brian Chabot, who was a libertarian, and combined they took over 4% of the vote. Day got about almost 18,000 votes, and Chabot got about 13,000 votes. That's not it. That's over 30,000 votes, and so I think that probably hurt her as well. But there's no denying she was in a very difficult position because she wanted to bring in independents, and so had to distance herself from Trump. But there was always a concern about retribution, and you could say in a sense that, you know, there may have been some people who voted for Day who sort of viewed it as kind of an abandonment of conservatism.
Well, some people, I've talked to several people who, I didn't actually talk to any voters myself, but I've talked to people who ran into voters, somebody who said they were at their mechanics and they're getting their car fixed and they had an I voted sticker on. They said, well, you know, how'd you vote? And he said, well, you know, I you know, voted for Trump and I didn't vote for Ayotte because she stepped away from Trump and I voted for Aaron Day. And, you know, it's true that Aaron Day got in this to thwart Ayotte. I was in touch with the Ayotte campaign when these numbers first started coming. I said, are you guys – do you believe that Day cost you the race? And they said, well, you know, it's really going to be a matter of looking where those votes came
from, right?
And, you know, at this point they may not be, you know, interested in doing that. But,
right.
you know, Day –
30,000 votes between those two independent candidates, or libertarian independent.
No question that had a big factor. But when you lose by 1,000 votes among almost 750,000 cast ballots, there are a lot of determining factors, and Trump certainly was one of them. I mean, if there are 50,000 – Trump gets 350,000 votes. If there's 50,000 people who like Trump and are angry with Ayotte that she did what she did, only 2% of them have to not vote for Ayotte, and that's 1,000 votes. And so was that a factor? It absolutely was. Was Aaron Day a factor? He absolutely was. And by the way – I've seen in having covered campaigns for a little while here in New Hampshire, this almost never works, which is protest candidates, I'm going to deny you the race by getting in the race and I'm going to siphon votes away from you. That was Aaron Day's strategy from the very beginning, and it actually worked.
All right. Well, now Governor Hassan heads to Washington. She'll be in the cooling saucer, as George Washington purportedly saw the Senate. With Donald Trump in the corner office, that cooling saucer, you know, could be a hot place. Why don't we take a listen to what Senator-elect Hassan said after she claimed victory Wednesday?
It will be my job in the United States Senate to make the best decisions for New Hampshire, to work with President-elect Trump when it is in the best interest of New Hampshire and the country, and to stand up to him when it isn't.
Okay, that was Senator-elect Maggie Hassan saying she would work with Donald Trump and it was in the best interest of New Hampshire and stand up to him when he was acting in a way that wasn't in New Hampshire's best interest. You know, there's a lot we don't know about what's going to go down in Washington with Trump in terms of his pursuit of priorities. And another thing we don't know is the future of Kelly Ayotte. You know, she's a rising star within her party, 48 years old, at various times said she'd only planned to serve 2 terms. Hard to know what she'll do. I mean, she could go kind of corporate boards, consulting a la John E. Sununu, could cool her heels in an academic setting, make another go of it like Jean Sheen did.
Actually some interesting reporting this morning, and a lot of it is speculative. But there's, you know, I'm looking at a headline in the National Review, a kind of conservative-leaning publication that says a Trump nomination to heal the party,
right.
Kelly Ayotte,
right.
which, you know, would be quite the move given
yes.
their kind of friction over the course of the campaign. I don't think there's any
quite far-fetched.
I think it's kind of one of these like kind of national media narratives is being put out there.
She's going to have to step on Rudy Giuliani if she wants to be Attorney General.
Or there's also talk about, you know, I've seen other talk about kind of a position, a high-level defense position or some kind of national security position.
Right.
Personally, I agree with you, Josh. I think that this is fairly unlikely at this point, but I'm not inside Ayotte world. I don't know what they're thinking.
Well,
but
Trump has shown a tendency to be instrumental when it helps him. He will, you know, he's very good at kind of, you know, he's an interesting paradox. Because on the one hand,
the art of
the
deal.
He's famous for holding grudges and he's thin-skinned, but on the other hand, he's very situational.
Well,
certainly
a very New Hampshire example was, you know, former Governor Sununu, who those guys were going sort of hammer and tongs during the primary, and then in Trump's last rallies here, it was Governor Sununu on stage. And Trump saying, you know, he was tough on me, but, you know, he's a great guy.
Yeah, even if you watched him yesterday in the Trump yesterday in the Oval Office with President Obama saying he's a great guy and they hit it off. And, you know, he's very good at kind of adapting to the situation.
But, I mean, for Ayotte, who said, you know, she was happy, she would be fine with Trump getting off the ballot. And it was because she wanted her daughter to someday understand where she stood.
Right.
It might be kind of hard to then say, aha, I'm joining his administration.
I just want to say one thing about Maggie Hassan. You know, you expect Democrats to say we're going to work together with President-elect Trump. But, you know, as soon as the Supreme Court nomination comes in and if they view it as too far or hard to the right, or if the first or second issue up is immigration or eliminating Obamacare, repealing Obamacare, you know, she'll caucus with Senate Democrats. There are going to be probably 48 of them. And figure out, you know, how to shut it down using filibusters and cloture votes and those sorts of techniques.
But well, there's also, you know, the issue of there's a lot of frustration, I think, among the Democratic base right now where, you know, Hassan and others are going to have to balance this idea of wanting to get things done and wanting to work with you know, their colleagues where it's, you know, applicable. But also, I think, you know, what you're seeing is a lot of Democrats saying, I don't want you to just sit down and put your hands up and, you know, just compromise
surrender
on everything. Yeah,
right.
I think there's a lot of hunger for them to fight in Congress as well. So I think we could maybe see a dynamic that we've seen in reverse over the last 4 years, 8 years.
Right. One of the things Governor Hassan talked about, and both Senator Shaheen as well talked about, was at every visit, Trump talked about the heroin crisis and how awestruck he was at how this epidemic was really affecting New Hampshire. And I promise you, I'm going to do something about it. Well, Shaheen was supporting emergency funding, and she had Ayotte support, but not many other Republicans, and not enough. And both Ayotte and Hassan said, there's an issue on which we believe it's a priority to get money, to federal resources to fight this epidemic right away. It sounds like President-elect Trump agrees with us, we're going to work with him.
Well, he certainly said that prior to when he was up here trying to get votes prior to the election, he said, I will 100% guarantee that, you know, we will stop the drugs and stop the poison from entering New Hampshire, which he says, you know, he finds incongruous with New Hampshire's beauty. So we shall see on that front. But another person who mentioned that she was eager to work with Trump on this front was, you know, reelected second CD member Annie Custer. And, you know, she spoke to reporters on Wednesday. Why don't we take a listen to what she said?
You know, look, the country is divided, and this election has exposed some real serious divisions, not just here in New Hampshire, frankly, less so here than across the country. So I want to use the New Hampshire way, this bipartisan bringing people together, Republicans and Democrats, on issues where we have common ground, and there are many of them.
All right. That was Annie Custer saying we will use the New Hampshire way, bring people that end issues where there are common ground. I mean, besides opiates, you know, does anything leap to mind?
Yeah, there are certainly infrastructure. That's something that this new president talked about that he'd like to get something done on. And to be sure, Trump's talking about a stronger, more robust military. And certainly this new delegation would love to see more resources go to the Portsmouth Naval Shipyard. And you were there, Josh, on Monday night, the day before the primary. He mentioned that. And so he'll certainly get a lot of Democratic nodding heads here.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Casey.
It remains to be seen, too, how Trump is going to make good on his campaign promise to kind of reform Washington and change the way that things work down there. You know, to the extent to which he's interested in campaign finance reform, that's something that Maggie Hassan talked a lot about on, or, you know, drew sharp contrasts with her opponent on during the Senate campaign. Perhaps that's an area of common ground where Democrats, you know, if there were some kind of meaningful reform to that end, I could see them maybe getting on board with that. But I think that, you know, it remains to be seen kind of how Trump's platitudes during the campaign are actually going to work in practice.
Which parts of the swamp
drain
discreetly.
You know, infrastructure is an interesting example. And Casey, you mentioned the Democratic base not wanting elected officials to cooperate too closely with Donald Trump. You know, infrastructure. I've heard Democrats say that infrastructure is one of those bills that Republicans had blocked in the Congress repeatedly. They didn't want to give it to Obama. Infrastructure is a big source of federal funds for the states. Nice. It builds political capital. So now to go to an infrastructure bill. You know, some Democrats are saying, hey, you know, they wouldn't give it when we had a Democratic president. So proceed carefully with Trump. So we'll see what kind of potential gridlock there might be.
It's important to point out here with this all Democratic female delegation, the first one in American history in New Hampshire, they all have experience working under Republican control. I mean, both senators, state senators, Jeanne Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, were in the state Senate when Republicans dominated. And both were governors when the Republican legislature was in charge at the State House. True as well, Annie Custer and Carol Shea Porter. Both have been in the Congress when Republicans held the Speaker's gavel. So they know how to try and navigate these pretty treacherous waters. These are certainly unprecedented ones with President Trump.
All right, tell us what you think after the break. There'll be more on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup in just a minute. Stick around. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or NHPR Exchange on Facebook and Twitter. Joining us this morning, Casey McDermott, NHPR, Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Why don't we go to the phones? Dave's on the line from Kingston. Good morning, Dave.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Go right ahead.
I have voted for the Democratic candidate in every election since Bill Clinton, and this time around, I voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary, and it was Gene Shaheen, Carol Shipporter, Ann Custer, anyway, they told me that my vote didn't matter, even though there was accusations of voter suppression in the Democratic primary, even though there were WikiLeaks emails that the DNC was condemning Tulsi Gabbard for supporting Bernie Sanders, even though there were emails and funding going to Hillary Clinton and not to Bernie Sanders. I feel like the Democratic Party, they propped up Hillary Clinton, and she didn't deserve to be there. She's been involved in a scandal every year for my entire life, for my entire political career. And I don't know why they were so adamant. I mean, maybe it was money, but they propped up a candidate. The people were behind Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders had the rallies, and he had the people to beat Donald Trump. And nobody is talking about the fact that the Democratic committee rigged this election, and it cost them. It cost them across the board.
Well, so just to be clear, did you voted for Hillary Clinton?
I voted for Bernie Sanders. I wrote in Bernie Sanders.
Okay. Thank you for calling, Dave. Interesting questions about rifts within the Democratic Party now. You know, there's been lots of talk about a bifurcated Republican Party, fissures in the party ideologically and culturally. You know, there's a lot of soul searching among Democrats. Certainly the knives are out at the DNC. You know, what do you think this election? I mean, Dave is a Bernie Sanders supporter who wrote in Sanders this week. You know, what do you think the future holds for Democrats on the front that you know, a lot of people who support of Sanders said Hillary Clinton was propped up and look what we got?
You know, it's interesting. We had this very intense competition between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton throughout the primaries, and Sanders came in as a progressive, not actually a member of the Democratic Party until he ran. And there was a lot of discussion about how he pulled Hillary Clinton to the left on issues like student debt, jobs, et cetera, you know, from her more sort of traditional centrist positions from the years in the Clinton administration. And then it kind of sort of went away a little bit during the general election. You didn't hear as much. Kind of Bernie Sanders was out on the stump occasionally for Hillary Clinton. You heard some unhappiness among his hardcore supporters. And this really sounds like it's going to be a continuation of that debate. Now, there has been some discussion about how there are actually some similarities between the issues that affected Trump supporters and the issues that drove Sanders supporters, that there was a commonality there on the economic dimension, and that the Clinton campaign did not sufficiently focus on that in places like the upper Midwest, Michigan, Wisconsin, and central Pennsylvania. So I think that debate now we're going to see spill out in terms of who takes control of the Democratic National Committee in the wake of the loss. And sure, you know, you always have some soul searching that goes on within the party when you lose the presidency.
Well, and there's certainly some, you know, irony for like long-term Clinton followers and certainly some of their long-term supporters here in the state would say that, you know, Bill Clinton's success was in connecting with the sorts of voters who, you know, for a variety of reasons seems to have bolted the Democratic Party for Trump.
And Clinton's just, I mean, part of that's a function of what you're essentially suggesting is that, you know, Hillary Clinton, and this has been kind of the rap on her all along for many years, not just in the campaign, that she's just not as good at making that kind of connection as Bill Clinton was, as Joe Biden is, and obviously as Trump was able to. And
we talked about Sanders,
absolutely. Right. We talked about the areas in the state where Trump was able to resonate with those kinds of voters.
I do think, though, in terms of this idea of campaigning and like one-on-one, I think that if you reporters that do see Hillary Clinton up close interacting with people, it's not that she's a robot or incapable of connecting with people. I think that it's an issue of broader messaging in this case rather than like the ability to retail campaign. Because if you look at even Sanders, he's not the kind of warm Bill Clinton shaking hands, kissing babies kind of politician.
But there was an authenticity to Sanders that for better or worse in terms of messaging, Hillary had a hard time breaking through and convincing folks of that. There isn't any question of that. I also believe, too, that so much of the background noise buried Hillary in the last month or so. All the WikiLeaks talking about a public position and a private position. Well, maybe I'm really not for trade deals, and maybe I am for trade deals. All of this stuff, as I said, only extended that narrative that this is a created politician, not one with real principles.
Just real quickly, having also spent time in small settings with both Hillary Clinton and interviewing Bernie Sanders individually on a number of occasions, absolutely I agree. Clinton is actually better in the small setting retail politics. But you look at the passion at the Trump rallies, you look at the passion at the Sanders rallies, no comparison with the orchestrated Clinton rallies.
Well,
it's just different.
You also don't get as much visceral anger from Clinton on the stump. And I think that's partially, if I'm being honest, a function of her gender, because I don't think that a woman could get away with being as angry as Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump are at their rallies. But just from my perspective. But I do think also, you know, like you said, it's a broader messaging issue. And it's also the fact that she has been in public life for literal decades and is kind of the victim of a lot of kind of preconceived scandals and caricatures that have been built up around her as well, which definitely did not help her in this election.
Yes. All right. Well, let's move down the ballot and into New Hampshire's other statewide race, the race for governor. You know, Republicans have a Republican in the corner office for the first time since 2003. Got an email from Christopher. He says, I think the Republicans took back the corner office because they finally fielded a more pragmatic, more moderate, and less ideological candidate in Chris Sununu. This worked in a purple state, said Christopher of Manchester. Do you think there's much to that, Kevin?
I do. I think Chris Sununu is a Republican that fits more of the profile of the New Hampshire voter. He's pro-choice. He is pragmatic. You talk to state agency heads that worked with him for the last number of terms on the executive council. They say we can work with this guy. He's a details guy. He very much wants all the information. And unless he gets all the information, he's not going to be supportive of you. But once he does get it all, he's got an open mind, and I think that's what we'll see with him as governor. Also, you can't discount the fact that he had a very recognizable name in New Hampshire. And for Republicans, a name that Republicans were anxious to embrace. I think that's why he got the support there. While Colin Van Ostern may have nearly, with all the help of special interest groups, by the way, may have outspent Chris Sununu 3-1. This race operated under the radar, and I'm convinced at least 1 in 3 voters went in, looked at the ballot, and said, Colin who?
Well, that's certainly what the polling indicated, that, you know, a lot of the good slug of them, despite all the ad spending and, you know, a campaign where he campaigned a lot and he was out there, that for whatever reason, it was hard to puncture all the noise at the top of the ticket, or people just weren't paying attention, that people didn't really know who he was.
Yeah, I think it's true that Sununu is a pretty good fit for a swing state or a purple state in terms of kind of his Republicanism. I do think that the issue for Colin Van Ostern was kind of statewide name recognition. He's very well known among Democrats, particularly Democratic activists, but he just I remember back in the primary, Sununu name recognition was up in the 40s, close to 50, and Collins was at about 14%. And I just don't think he was able to overcome that. Sununu was also smart. You know, he kind of embraced Trump, but not too much. He just sort of flew below the radar. He didn't have the dust ups that Kelly Ayotte had with him, and so he didn't have that sort of punitive vote to deal with as well.
Why don't we go to the phones? We have Mark on the phone from Exeter. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. It's great to hear your program. I always look forward to Friday's exchange.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Yes, my question is following up on a previous caller. First, with a comment, I find it ironic that the Democratic primary structure this past spring was much less Democratic with a small d than the Republican primary, and it was much less one person, one vote, given the fact that there were superdelegates. Most of them committed to Hillary Clinton, who were appointed and not elected. And I find that an ironic twist, and maybe as a Monday morning quarterback, would like to ask the panel, had the Democratic primary been more like the Republican one in terms of a more direct proportionality of delegates going to the convention to the outcome of the primaries, would the result have been different, and might Bernie Sanders have actually been the nominee? Because I can't help but wonder, as a Monday morning quarterback, if Sanders' appeal to the people who swung over to Trump in the Midwestern states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, can't help but wonder that whether Sanders would have done much better there, flipped one of those states, and that we'd be facing a very different outcome right now.
Good question, Mark. That would require more numbers crunching than I'm capable of doing on the fly.
My understanding is that Clinton did actually get more popular votes nationwide than Sanders. I don't know the exact margin over that, and I don't know how that would translate into delegate math. And again, that could also be because she was winning more delegates, you know, maybe in the states that awarded them all or nothing in primaries or where there were super delegates. And maybe later on in the process, people thought, oh, well, she's winning, so I'm going to back her anyway. So we don't really know how those dynamics played out. But it is my understanding that at the end of the day, at the end of the primary process, she did actually get more votes than Sanders.
You know, it's interesting. I think political scientists, too, are going to they're going to study this election for generations for a lot of reasons, but I think this is one of them is we don't have all the tabulated write-in votes as yet by candidate either, but we found it interesting, and Dean referred to it earlier in the program, that more people voted in the U.S. Senate race for the candidates on the ballot than voted for Trump and Clinton, which suggests to me at least that Bernie Sanders got a lot of write-in votes, and those were all taken away from Hillary Clinton, and perhaps her margin would have been bigger in New Hampshire. And I'd be really interested to see what kind of write-in vote existed, for example, for Bernie Sanders in Michigan, who, by the way, rocked Clinton during the primaries. You'll remember Clinton was way up in the polls in Michigan, and Sanders won that primary.
Well, one thing that is interesting also is that, you know, in New Hampshire, there was a fairly strong strain of a kind of a never Trump feeling among your more establishment Republicans. And so I talked to plenty who said that they left that line on the ballot blank. Let's go to a comment from Facebook. Tim writes, legislative control has flip-flopped over the last decade. The corner office hasn't. What many folks don't appreciate is how important vetoes, or the threat of vetoes by first Governor Lynch, then Governor Hassan, have been in shaping policy. Presumably, Governor-elect Sununu won't stand in the way of Republican legislatures' actions very often. You know, I think that's an interesting point, Tim. And, you know, we can go down on the issues where that's been a major factor. You could talk about right to work. You can talk about gun laws, election laws, and, Medicaid expansion. There's some dynamics there as well. Why don't we listen to some tape that Chris Sununu said about Medicaid expansion, for instance.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, our proposed Medicaid expansion plan was just rejected by CMS. So Washington, D.C. stood up and said, we don't care what New Hampshire wants. We're going to do it our way. Well, I tell you what, I take real issue with that. New Hampshire has to have a voice. They have to have a governor and leadership that is going to push back and say, look, if you want this to come down the path the way it looks, we are going to have the initiatives that we see as important for our people and our constituents.
All right, that's Chris Sununu on Medicaid expansion. He's talking about severability, which was a clause in the law that Republicans pushed for that people knew was going to be rejected by the federal government, basically. It'll be interesting to see what Chris Sununu does vis-a-vis Washington and also around the State House. I mean, do you get the sense, Kevin, that Republicans, you know, after, you know, nearly two decades of Democrats, there's a pent-up demand for action on certain gun laws? I mean, Chris Sununu said he would support concealed carry without a permit, for instance. On, you know, abortion is a more complicated one because of Chris Sununu's positions there, but on some election law issues, on right to work, are those things going to cruise through?
Well, I think there'll be a hit or miss here. You've got a smaller Republican delegation in the House. They still have the majority in the New Hampshire House. There'll be a fight for who's going to be the Speaker. That will, by the way, determine a lot of this. Meaning that if Sean Jasper were to be defeated as Speaker and replaced by another Republican among the three who are now running in that race, I think all three would pursue a more robust Republican-conservative agenda than he would. Let's start with right to work. Right to work's not passing the House with the makeup that exists here. I think there'll be enough pro-union Republicans to deny a right to work to pass. Sununu has said he'd sign it. The state Senate would pass it. But there are issues, I think election law reform, things such as the residency requirement that Governor Hassan vetoed, concealed carry repeal, I think has a very good chance of passing. Again, it's in the details, and that's one of the things Chris Sununu was very articulate in stating during this campaign was he gave broad strokes to a lot of these policies, but in many cases he talked about how I have to see the details. I have to see if this works to my liking, if it fits New Hampshire's profile. I don't think he's going to be a doctrinaire, ideological, far-right conservative governor. I just don't see it.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, you know, on some issues, on guns, for instance, he said repeatedly that he, you know, believes in constitutional carry.
Yes.
And I guess, you know, I guess it would depend on how you draw that up. But that's pretty straightforward. I mean, if you, you know, you can carry a gun concealed is what it boils down to. And that was a point of friction where, you know, it's interesting that historically this was not something – I mean, I don't know whether this is a product of just – changing views among Republicans or the fact that you had a Democratic backstop for so long that a lot of these issues when Craig Benson first got in there would have been considered kind of out there for Republicans to pursue, right to work, some of these concealed carry issues, you know, having been vetoed repeatedly by Democrats, it's become kind of normalized as part of, you know, what Republicans consider. Maybe the world has changed, but I'm going to be very curious to see what Sununu does with all of these.
Yeah, and I think guns is a key issue. We see the National Rifle Association nationally being hyped as a winner in this election, and I think that's accurate. Trump's a big supporter of defending the Second Amendment, and Sununu can look to New Hampshire as well as an example of the power of the gun lobby. We haven't really talked about this yet, but the gun lobby soured on Senator Kelly Ayotte. The New Hampshire Firearms Coalition gave her a D grade. They gave an A grade to Aaron Day in this race. And there's no doubt in my mind that a good degree of the support that Aaron Day ended up getting were disaffected gun folks who weren't happy that on a number of occasions Kelly Ayotte was open not to discussing gun control but even bringing things to a vote in the Senate.
But I mean, do you think that's simply on the no-fly, no-buy compromise that she worked on with Susan Collins that failed?
Yeah, absolutely. And other issues where she refused to support a filibuster against a gun control bill, even after Sandy Hook.
I'm going to be interested to see, paradoxically, if sales of guns and ammunition actually goes down, because we often see that whenever there's a big Democratic victory nationally, the presidency, Congress, gun and ammo sales go up because people think that the laws are going to be tightened. Now that we have a Donald Trump coming in and a Republican Congress, it'd be interesting to see the paradox of sales actually decline a little bit.
All right. We'll be more on this governor's race. Tell us what you think. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. You know, one thing, the state Senate balance, you mentioned it quickly, Kevin, and we have just a moment. You know, we're pretty much holding steady with 13-11 or 14-10. Right. You don't see the temperament of that body changing meaningfully. We still have the same leaders.
We really do, yeah. Both Senate President Chuck Morris was reelected by his caucus, Nash, and Democratic leader Jeff Woodburn. I think both will take over those roles and I think govern in very similar fashions.
All right. More after the break. Granite State headlines on our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, Election Autopsy Edition. Stick around. Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests this week are Kevin Landrigan, New Hampshire Union leader, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, and Casey McDermott, NHPR. And Casey, you spent a lot of time with Governor-elect Chris Sununu during this campaign. And, you know, Kevin says he's not a, you know, he doesn't expect to see a real doctrinaire Republican and that there were a lot of broad strokes in the campaign trail. We're waiting on details. You know, what do you think we're going to get out of Chris Sununu from the get-go?
I mean, I think he's pitching himself, as we've said, as someone who can work across party lines. His first big message at his press conference post-election the other day was, you know, now is the time to come together, work together for the people of New Hampshire, preaching kind of a message of healing, both after the election at the national level and also what we're seeing at the state level. So I think that, you know, if he wants to follow through on that promise, then he would be wise to be someone who does seek to work across party lines. And I think, you know, you get the sense that he is genuinely interested in that and in building bridges with, you know, potentially Democratic legislative leaders and otherwise. On the issue of Medicaid, I think that's going to be a really interesting one to watch, both because of its implications for a number of people in the state. We have about 50,000 people, if not more, who rely on that for their health care coverage right now. And there's a big question mark around what's going to happen with that under both a Trump administration in terms of what he does with the Affordable Care Act and what that would mean for the funding of the program, given that the program in New Hampshire is funded right now 100% through federal funds and moving forward through a large portion of federal funds. Sununu has said he's been a little bit hard to pin down on exactly what he would do with Medicaid expansion. But I think that, you know, it's going to be a balance between, you know, what do I do to not pull the rug out from all of these people on their health care coverage and not anger a lot of people in the process, a lot of constituents, but also how do I balance the kind of fiscal responsibility that he says that he wants to uphold in, you know, kind of maybe reining in the program if needed.
Hmm. Another issue that was a big one in this race, even though Chris Sununu is pro-choice in terms of abortion rights, is sort of abortion and contraception, and certainly Planned Parenthood, you know, went after him and really in support of Democrat Colin Van Ostern. And, you know, Republicans, after, again, years of Democratic control, some of the conservatives are looking for, you know, some new laws there. And why don't we take a listen to what Chris Sununu said at the press conference you referred to this week.
I've always said I'm against late-term abortions. I would love to see a fetal homicide bill done. I think that protects women who have been violated and lost late-term pregnancies. The Women's Health Protection Act, I think, is something that we really have to look at, which provides women the same level of care no matter where they go and what procedures they might have. I think that's something that women deserve in the state, and it has to be looked at. These type of initiatives are things we're going to look at very closely. I am pro-choice. I believe in a woman's right to choose the best path forward for her and her family.
All right, that was Chris Sununu talking about abortion and related issues. He said he would love to have a fetal homicide bill in New Hampshire. That's been a complicated and fraught topic at the legislature for some time. He also talked about a Women's Health Protection Act. And Casey, what exactly is that?
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what he means by that specifically, I should clarify. So I did ask his campaign to clarify that after the press conference. I have not received a definitive answer as to what type of legislation he's referring to. I do know that in other states, and I believe in New Hampshire recently, that type of legislation has referred to the idea of kind of stepping up or creating stricter regulations on facilities that do perform abortions. So perhaps
like a licensing,
like ambulatory requirements, surgical requirements, things like that. Those who are in favor of not peeling back abortion rights have raised concerns with this legislation as, you know, creating kind of needlessly complicated rules for facilities that eventually lead them to shut down. That's something that we've seen in other states. I believe Texas, for example, we saw some clinics close there as a result of legislation like this. But again, I don't know whether that is definitively what Chris Sununu was talking about in this case. But he did say in that sentence, you know, that, you know, to make sure that people are receiving the same standards. So in some way, I think that that's signaling that he's interested in kind of streamlining the standards or the regulations that would be applied across the board to facilities that perform abortions.
All right, let's go to an email. Jordan writes, and Jordan's from Auburn, on the subject of Sununu and commuter rail as a subject line. According to Jordan, the New Hampshire economy wants it, municipalities want it, the people want it, and the environment would benefit from it. It's narrowing the scope. I love living in New Hampshire, but having a Bostonian career and enjoyment of nightlife, I need it to stay. Is there any hope of moving forward with commuter rail with Chris Sununu? No indications based on his talk. I mean, $300 million boondoggle,
yeah,
repeatedly.
Yeah, this has become increasingly, and we've talked about this for months and probably years at this point on the weekly roundup. It's increasingly become a litmus test between conservatives and progressives. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, if you're conservative or even Republican, you're against commuter rail because it's heavily subsidized by government. Libertarians view it as kind of Big Brother telling you to get out of your SUV and get on a train, and they don't want that either. you know, the only way that I could even see this conceivably, you know, sort of being moved down the field in terms of maybe studying or taking federal money, even just taking the $4 million to study this was problematic, would be if there's some big groundswell among pro-business Republicans in Nashua and Manchester. But, you know, there's already been some of that. And as you said, he still called it a $300 million boondoggle. So I don't think people should start buying their tickets.
I think it would depend heavily on what kind of incentives the federal government would offer. I mean, I think that if it's something where it would require a significant amount of state funding, then I think it's off the table for now completely. But and I'm skeptical that that kind of federal funding would come forward in the next few years. But I think that, you know, Chris Sununu has signaled that he is skeptical about the value of rail repeatedly on the campaign
trail. The problem you've heard from Republicans on this idea of incentivizing rail with federal dollars is it's stopgap. At some point, the argument will be, just like it is with Medicaid expansion, that the state will get stuck with the bill even if it's 5 or 10 years down the road.
Well, there are other issues that it's interesting. You know, certainly Republicans have their sort of wish list of issues that they were hoping for with a Republican governor, and, you know, to the emailer's point, Democrats had their wish list, you know, rail, minimum wage, full day kindergarten, those sorts of things. Do you think that under Chris Sununu, Kevin, we're going to see movement on anything? Not minimum. I mean, pretty clear on minimum wage, but are we going to see anything that is going to be, you know, out of the Democratic bucket at all?
It's possible. I think Sununu is going to want to try and look for that. Look for some kind of, I hate to use the term sop, but something that he can throw to Democrats in the legislature. After all, as I say, on some of these issues, with a more conservative Republican caucus, he may need the Democrats on some of his budget priorities as well. So if he can create some kind of incentive that's not too expensive, for example, for full-day kindergarten, he may well go along with it, because Democrats will then support his, you know, science and engineering incentive on the education front.
Well, and that's one of the things that I think, if I recall, Van Ostern in his kind of concession letter noted, the full-day kindergarten is something where they seem to have some general agreement.
Sununu has said that he does support full-day kindergarten, but for him it was, again, he's very big on kind of local control. Mm-hmm. So he stressed that kind of the distinction between him and Van Ostern. Van Ostern wanted to make it statewide. Sununu wanted to leave it up to local districts.
I mean, another issue that Sununu was quite loud and, you know, not terribly clear on, but that he did mention was, you know, we need a constitutional amendment on school funding. And that's something that, like, you know, has gotten less and less of attention in recent years. And, you know, I don't know how many of those you've written about, Kevin, but, you know, many.
Too many.
And so, I mean, do you expect that we're going to get another kind of try to push that rock up the hill again?
We could. I do think, you know, the Supreme Court's decision with regard to the Dover case, which essentially said the legislature, it was unconstitutional. It was a Superior Court decision, I'm sorry, that has been appealed to Supreme Court. Superior Court judge said it was unconstitutional to place a cap on these communities that have growing enrollment. You can't get any more education aid despite how big your enrollments become. That Superior Court judge said that's unconstitutional. That could create some kind of more momentum, if you will. I think there'll be full debate about constitutional amendments. I just have, as you pointed out, we've been down this road so many times, and the threshold for a constitutional amendment, 60% vote in both the House and the Senate, is so high that I have my serious doubts that an amendment would go to the voters anytime soon.
All right. David is on the phone from Keene. Good morning, David. Go right ahead.
Hi. I was seriously thinking about, I would have voted for Jim Lawrence, but then I heard you interviewing him, and he, like, so obviously dodged the abortion question. If he had given an honest answer one way of the or the other in response to your queries, I probably would have voted for him, but it was so obvious, his dodge, and that's all I got. Thanks.
All right, thank you, David. Now, you know, we haven't touched on the congressional races. You know, second CD, Annie Kutcher was reelected. It was a bit closer than a lot of people anticipated. You know, David may be a voter who says Jim Lawrence lost his support because of his inexplicit in his on abortion when he was interviewed on NHPR, but I mean the guy's positions were pretty clear, you know, on paper. He was a conservative. He ran as a conservative, and that's one reason why a lot of people didn't give him a shot in that district yet. He did pretty well. Dean, is this just simply Trump effect?
Well, that's people on election night. We're talking a lot about Trump tails or Trump coattails in the second CD. And as you mentioned, the conventional wisdom here is that this district, particularly the Upper Valley, you know, Keene up through Lebanon, Hanover, and then over to Concord, it's increasingly Democratic. We saw Charlie Bass over many years increasingly as a Republican tack to the center representing that district. And on top of that, you know, we saw in the last election Annie Custer take on Marilyn Garcia and defeat her quite easily, painting her as a sort of extreme conservative. So the anticipation was that he would lose pretty handily. I do think he benefited from the strong Trump vote in places like Claremont and on some of these other small towns and rural areas that feel some economic dislocation. You know, she had, I think, $3 or $4 million. It was a big lopsided advantage in terms of resources. He was not particularly well known. He had bad headlines on his personal life.
Well, there's not a single good story about him.
Exactly. Like, okay, like, so it seemed almost like his resume
may have been trumped up a bit. Right. He wasn't paying his property taxes or
child support. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, Republicans come out of this election and say, we really dropped the ball here.
Well, no one was watching that district, and not just
in that race, but in the first congressional district as well. What if we had establishment-wise done more, gotten more horsepower? Does anybody think, based on what happened on Tuesday, that if Rich Ashew had been the Republican nominee, that he'd be the congressman and not Carol Shea-Porter in the first district? Because I do. And I think for 2018, that's going forward, I think that's one of the state GOP's priority now, is that they truly feel that the electorate was ready for change. The electorate is sick of a do-nothing Congress. And if these Congresswomen, who are going to be in the minority, as I say, aren't going to have a lot of accomplishments to talk about in 2 years, we can take them out.
Well, you have to wonder if, you know, the fact that Lawrence did a little bit better than people were expecting him to in the second CD, I would think that, you know, maybe in the past that made it difficult to recruit solid Republicans to run there, because there was this assumption that, you know, they're going to lose no matter what. But the fact that he was within, what, 5 points of
4 points
of Congresswoman Annie Custer, you know, maybe we're going to see people who I think I've seen some reporting that maybe some of the people who ran for governor this year could re-emerge there. So I think that maybe this would send a signal to Republicans to maybe step up their recruiting a little bit more to field maybe a stronger candidate next time around, with the hopes that it would be better for them.
It's got to be Governor-elect Chris Sununu's one of his top priorities, and here's why. In 2018, there's no presidential race. In 2018, there's no U.S. Senate race. So he's at the top of the ballot, and there's not going to be any big national money coming in here. And if he's got to worry about weak congressional candidates getting waxed by sitting congressmen, then he's in a lot more trouble for re-election than he would be otherwise.
I think that's a good point. We're going to touch on CD1 for a moment. Obviously, you know, fourth time. Ginton, Shea-Porter are 2-2 in the presidential years. Shea-Porter has won.
We're setting up for the off years.
Ginton has won.
Rocky Five.
You know, why don't Sean O'Connor? We got to talk about him too. He got in the race. I mean, do you think he? You know, hard to know exactly where he pulled votes from, but I mean, he got around 10%. This margin was pretty narrow at the top. Have to say, a lot of people that wouldn't have thought Frank Ginton would have gotten as far as he did, given the last year he's had, with people calling for him to resign. Is there anything we can take away from this race other than it's a narrowly divided district, particularly in a presidential year, and people were well aware of at least two of their options?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the district is still fluid. It's going to continue to have this sort of, you know, swing feel to it. O'Connor turned out to be an interesting case. I mean, like you said, he got 9, almost 10% of the vote. That's not insignificant. I think it'll maybe take a little while to figure out where those votes came from. My guess is, you know, although, you know, Carol Shea-Porter is now going to be the incumbent again, that there just seems to have been kind of energy within both parties to kind of move beyond this matchup at some point. You know, I guess in theory, if it's 2-2, Josh, maybe Ginton will try to break the tie in 2 years. But I think there's going to be, you know, as you said, it'll be a priority to kind of find someone new to run in that district to take on Shea-Porter in what will be a midterm year, which has generally been better for Republicans.
Now, here the opportunities are good for New Hampshire Republicans, and here's why. With a Republican elected Donald Trump and a defeated congressman Frank Ginter, who went out of his way, by the way, to embrace Donald Trump, and the Republican establishment in the state wanting to move on past Frank Ginter, I think there'd be a robust effort to try and find a federal job for Frank Ginter that could take him out of a race in 2 years, so we can, so Republicans can clean the slate and in their minds, hopefully have a much better chance of taking back that seat.
All right. Before we go, let's touch briefly on one thing we haven't talked about is the council. You know, that Republicans control that as well. You know, that should presumably make life a little easier for Governor-elect Sununu. But, you know, these things can change quickly. Any big takeaways out of those races, Kevin?
Yeah, certainly with the council, we now have a 3-2 majority just as we had before. But it's a different 3-2 than it was before. I mean, Russ Prescott in District 3, for example, for Chris Sununu, is a much more conservative Republican than Chris Sununu is. And
he's
certainly
willing to go alone if he believes
absolutely
something.
Yeah, no, and even has done that on some bipartisan issues as well. And
Andrew Walensky brings an interesting and different.
I mean, he's said that I think he wants to bring kind of a progressive mindset to the council,
yes,
which, you know, is a continuation of the idea that that body is going to get even more political over time.
And
too.
He does seem to have a more sweeping view of the council's sort of mandate,
yes,
than do a lot of,
yeah,
people who have served there in the past.
Yeah, and the fact that you've got in the other Democrat, Chris Pappas, somebody who they now see as a real shining star and someone they want to promote.
All right. Thanks for joining us at Friday News Roundup on NHPR. Have a good weekend, and it's Veterans Day.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.